I say it's the best shot. We'd have a goddamn stampede if people thought Lecter was out. Papers all over us screaming. Best shot, maybe, but we'll save it for last. He probably wouldn't come near a mail drop, but he might be curious enough to look at a mail drop to see if Lecter had sold him. If he could do it from a distance, we could pick a drop that could be watched from only a few places a long way off and stake out the observation points. It sounded weak to Graham, even as he said it. Secret Service has a setup they've never used. They'd let us have it. But if we don't put an ad in today, we'll have to wait until Monday before the next issue comes out. Presses roll at 5, our time. That gives Chicago another hour and 15 minutes to come up with Lecter's ad, if there is one. What about Lecter's ad order? The letter he'd have to send the Tatler ordering the ad. Could we get to that quicker? Chicago put out some general feelers to the shop foreman, Crawford said. The mail stays in the classified advertising manager's office. They sell the names and return addresses to mailing lists. Outfits that sell products for lonely people. Love charms, rooster pills, squack dealers, meet beautiful Asian girls, personality courses, that sort of stuff. We might appeal to the ad manager's citizenship and all, and get a look, request him to be quiet, but I don't want to chance it and risk the Tatler slobbering all over us. It would take a warrant to go in there and bogart the mail. I'm thinking about it. If Chicago turns up nothing, we could put an ad in anyway. If we're wrong about the Tatler, we wouldn't lose anything, Graham said. And if we're right that the Tatler is the medium, and we make up a reply based on what we have in this note and screw it up, if it doesn't look right to him, we're down the tubes. I didn't ask you about Birmingham. Anything? Birmingham's shut down and over with. The Jacoby house has been painted and redecorated, and it's on the market. Their stuff is in storage waiting for probate. I went through the crates. The people I talked to didn't know the Jacobys very well. The one thing they always mentioned was how affectionate the Jacobys were to each other, always patting. Nothing left of them now but 5 pallet loads of stuff in a warehouse. I wish I had... Quit wishing. You're on it now. What about the mark on the tree? You hit it on the head? Means nothing to me, Crawford said. The red dragon either. Beverly knows Mahjong. She's sharp, and she can't see it. We know from his hair he's not Chinese. He cut the limb with a bolt cutter. I don't see... Crawford's telephone rang. He spoke into it briefly. Lab's ready on the note, Will. Let's go up to Zeller's office. It's bigger and not so gray. Lloyd Bowman, dry as a document in spite of the heat, caught up with them in the corridor. He was flapping damp photographs in each hand and held a sheaf of data fact sheets under his arm. Jack, I have to be in court at 4:15, he said as he flapped ahead. It's that paper hanger Nilton Eskew and his sweetheart Nan. She could draw a treasury note freehand. They've been driving me crazy for 2 years, making their own traveler's checks on a color Xerox. Won't leave home without them. Will I make it in time, or should I call the prosecutor? You'll make it, Crawford said. Here we are. Beverly Katz smiled at Graham from the couch in Zeller's office, making up for the scowl of Price beside her. Scientific Analysis Section Chief Brian Zeller was young for his job, but already his hair was thinning, and he wore bifocals. On the shelf, behind Zeller's desk, Graham saw H.G. Wall's Forensic Science text, Tedeschi's Great Forensic Medicine in 3 volumes, and an antique edition of Hopkins' The Wreck of the Deutschland. Will... We met once at GWU, I think, he said. Do you know everybody? Fine. Crawford leaned against the corner of Zeller's desk, his arms folded. Anybody got a blockbuster? Okay. Does anything you found indicate the note did not come from the Tooth Fairy? No, Bowman said. I talked to Chicago a few minutes ago to give them some numerals. I picked up from an impression on the back of the note. 666. I'll show you when we get to it. Chicago has over 200 personal ads so far. He handed Graham a sheaf of DataFax copies. I've read them, and they're all the usual stuff. Marriage offers, appeals to runaways. I'm not sure how we'd recognize the ad if it's here. Crawford shook his head. I don't know either. Let's break down the physical. Now, Jimmy Price did everything we could do, and there was no print. What about you, Bev?
I got one whisker.
Scale count and core size match samples from Hannibal Lecter. So does color. The color is markedly different from samples taken in Birmingham and Atlanta. Three blue grains and some dark flecks went to Brian's end. She raised her eyebrows at Brian Zeller. The grains were commercial granulated cleaner with chlorine, he said. It must have come off the cleaning man's hands. There were several very minute particles of dried blood. It's definitely blood, but there's not enough to type. The tears at the end of the pieces wandered off the perforations, Beverly Katz continued. If we find the roll in somebody's possession, and he hasn't torn it again, we can get a definite match. I recommend issuing an advisory now, so the arresting officers will be sure to search for the roll. Crawford nodded. Bowman? Sharon from my office went after the paper and got samples to match. It's toilet tissue for marine heads and motorhomes. The texture matches brand name Whittaker, manufactured in Minneapolis. It has nationwide distribution. Bowman set up his photographs on an easel near the windows. His voice was surprisingly deep for his slight stature, and his bow tie moved slightly when he talked. On the handwriting itself, this is a right-handed person using his left hand and printing in a deliberate block pattern. You can see the unsteadiness in the strokes and varying letter sizes. The proportions make me think our man has a touch of uncorrected astigmatism. The inks on both pieces of the note look like the same standard ballpoint royal blue in natural light, but a slight difference appears under colored filters. He used two pens, changing somewhere in the missing section of the note. You can see where the first one began to skip. The first pen is not used frequently. See the blob it starts with? It might have been stored point down and uncapped in a pencil jar or canister, which suggests a desk situation. Also, the surface the paper lay on was soft enough to be a blotter. A blotter might retain impressions if you find it. I want to add the blotter to Beverly's advisory. Bowman flipped to a photograph of the back of the note. The extreme enlargement made the paper look fuzzy. It was grooved with shadowed impressions. He folded the note to write the bottom part, including what was later torn out. In this enlargement of the backside, oblique light reveals a few impressions. We can make out 666 A.N. Maybe that's where he had pen trouble and had to bear down and overwrite. I didn't spot it until I had this high-contrast print. There's no 666 in any ad so far. The sentence structure is orderly, and there's no rambling. The folds suggest it was delivered in a standard letter-size envelope. These two dark places are printing ink smudges. The note was probably folded inside some innocuous printed matter in the envelope. "That's about it," Bowman said. "Unless you have questions, Jack, I'd better go to the courthouse. I'll check in after I testify." "Sink 'em deep," Crawford said. Graham studied the Tatler Personals column. Attractive queen-size lady, young 52, seeks Christian Leo, non-smoker, 40 to 70. No children, please. Artificial limb welcomed. No phonies. Send photo first letter. Lost in the pain and desperation of the ads, he didn't notice that the others were leaving until Beverly Katz spoke to him. "I'm sorry, Beverly, what did you say?" He looked at her bright eyes and kindly, well-worn face. "I just said I'm glad to see you back, champ. You're looking good." "Thanks, Beverly." "Saul's going to cooking school. He's still hit or miss,
But when the dust settles, come over and let him practice on you.
I'll do it. Zeller went away to prowl his laboratory. Only Crawford and Graham were left, looking at the clock. 40 minutes to Tatler press time, Crawford said. I'm going after their mail. What do you say?
I think you have to.
Crawford passed the word to Chicago on Zeller's telephone. Will, we need to be ready with a substitute ad if Chicago bingos.
I'll work on it.
I'll set up the drop. Crawford called the Secret Service and talked at some length. Graham was still scribbling when he finished.
Okay, the mail drop's a beauty, Crawford said at last.
It's an outside message box on a fire extinguisher service outfit in Annapolis. That's Lecter territory. The Tooth Fairy will see that it's something Lecter could know about. Alphabetical pigeonholes. The service people drive up to it and get assignments and mail. Our boy can check it out from a park across the street. Secret Service swears it looks good. They set it up to catch a counterfeiter, but it turned out they didn't need it. Here's the address. What about the message?
We have to use two messages in the same edition. The first one warns the Tooth Fairy that his enemies are closer than he thinks. It tells him he made a bad mistake in Atlanta, and if he repeats the mistake, he's doomed. It tells him, Lecter has mailed secret information. I showed Lecter about what we're doing, how close we are, the leads we have. It directs the Tooth Fairy to a second message that begins with, your signature. The second message begins, avid fan, and contains the address of the mail drop. We have to do it that way. Even in roundabout language, the warning in the first message is going to excite some casual nuts. If they can't find out the address, they can't come to the drop and screw things up.
Good. Damn good. Want to wait it out in my office?
I'd rather be doing something. I need to see Brian Zeller.
Go ahead. I can get you in a hurry if I have to.
Graham found the section chief in serology. Brian, could you show me a couple of things?
Sure. What?
The samples you used to type the Tooth Fairy. Zeller looked at Graham through the close-range section of his bifocals.
Was there something in the report you didn't understand?
No.
Was something unclear?
No.
Something incomplete?
Zeller mouthed the word as if it had an unpleasant taste. Your report was fine. Couldn't ask for better. I just want to hold the evidence in my hand.
Ah, certainly. We can do that.
Zeller believed that all field men retain the superstitions of the hunt. He was glad to humor Graham.
It's all together down at that end.
Graham followed him between the long counters of apparatus. You're reading Tedeschi?
Yes, Zeller said over his shoulder. We don't do any forensic medicine here, as you know, but Tedeschi has a lot of useful things in there.
Graham, Will Graham, you wrote the standard monograph on determining time of death by insect activity, didn't you?
Or do I have the right Graham?
I did it.
A pause. You're right. Mant and Nuorteva in the Tedeschi are better on insects. Zeller was surprised to hear his thought spoken.
Well, it does have more pictures and a table of invasion waves. No offense.
Of course not. They're better.
I told them so.
Zeller gathered vials and slides from a cabinet and a refrigerator and set them on the laboratory counter.
If you want to ask me anything, I'll be where you found me. The stage light on this microscope is on the side here.
Graham did not want the microscope. He doubted none of Zeller's findings. He didn't know what he wanted. He raised the vials and slides to the light, and a glassine envelope with two blonde hairs found in Birmingham. A second envelope held three hairs found on Mrs. Leeds. There were spit and hair and semen on the table in front of Graham, an empty air where he tried to see an image, a face, something to replace the shapeless dread he carried.
A woman's voice came from a speaker in the ceiling. "Graham, Will Graham, to Special Agent Crawford's office, on red." He found Sarah in her headset typing, with Crawford looking over her shoulder. "Chicago's got an ad order with 666 in it," Crawford said out of the side of his mouth. "They're dictating it to Sarah now. They said part of it looks like code." The lines were climbing out of Sarah's typewriter. "Dear Pilgrim, you honor me." "That's it. That's it," Graham said. "Lecter called him a pilgrim when he was talking to me." "You're very beautiful." "Christ," Crawford said. "I offer 100 prayers for your safety. Find help in John 622, 816, 91, Luke 1731, Galatians 611, 15:2, Acts 3:3, Revelation 18:7, Jonah 6:8. The typing slowed as Sarah read back each pair of numbers to the agent in Chicago. When she had finished, the list of scriptural references covered a quarter of a page. It was signed, "Bless You, 666. "That's it," Sarah said. Crawford picked up the phone. "Okay, Chester, how did it go down with the ad manager?" "No, you did right. A complete clam, right. Stand by at that phone. I'll get back to you." "Code," Graham said. "Has to be. We've got 22 minutes to get a message in, if we can break it. Shop foreman needs 10 minutes' notice and $300 to shoehorn one in this edition. Bowman's in his office. He got a recess. If you'll get him cracking, I'll talk to cryptography at Langley. Sarah, shoot a telex of the ad to CIA cryptography section. I'll tell him it's coming." Bowman put the message on his desk and aligned it precisely with the corners of his blotter. He polished his rimless spectacles for what seemed to Graham a very long time. Bowman had a reputation for being quick. Even the explosive section forgave him for not being an ex-Marine and granted him that. "We have 20 minutes," Graham said. "I understand. You called Langley?" "Crawford did." Bowman read the message many times, looked at it upside down and sideways, ran down the margins with his finger. He took a Bible from his shelves. For 5 minutes, the only sounds were the two men breathing and the crackle of onion skin pages. "No," he said. "We won't make it in time. Better use what's left for whatever else you can do." Graham showed him an empty hand. Bowman swiveled around to face Graham and took off his glasses. He had a pink spot on each side of his nose. "Do you feel fairly confident the note to Lecter is the only communication he's had from your tooth fairy?" "Right." "The code is something simple, then. They only needed cover against casual readers. Measuring by the perforations in the note to Lecter, only about 3 inches is missing. That's not much room for instructions. The numbers aren't right for a jailhouse alphabet grid, the tap code. I'm guessing it's a book code." Crawford joined them. "Book code?" "Looks like it. The first numeral, that 100 prayers, could be the page number. The paired numbers in the scriptural references could be line and letter. But what book?" "Not the Bible?" Crawford said. "No, not the Bible. I thought it might be at first. Galatians 6:11 threw me off. Ye see how large a letter I have written unto you with mine own hand." "That's appropriate. But it's coincidence, because next he has Galatians 15:2. Galatians has only 6 chapters. Same with Jonah 6:8. Jonah has 4 chapters. He wasn't using a Bible. Maybe the book title could be concealed in the clear part of Lecter's message," Crawford said. Bowman shook his head. "I don't think so." "Then the Tooth Fairy named the book to use.
He specified it in his note to Lecter, Graham said.
It would appear so, Bowman said.
What about sweating Lecter? In a mental hospital, I would think drugs. They tried sodium amytal on him 3 years ago, trying to find out where he buried a Princeton student, Graham said. He gave them a recipe for dip. Besides, if we sweat him, we lose the connection. If the Tooth Fairy picked the book, it's something he knew Lecter would have in his cell.
I know for sure he didn't order one or borrow one from Chilton, Crawford said.
What of the papers carried about that, Jack, about Lecter's books?
That he has medical books, psychology books, cookbooks.
Then it could be one of the standards in those areas, something so basic the Tooth Fairy knew Lecter would definitely have it, Bowman said.
We need a list of Lecter's books. Do you have one?
No. Graham stared at his shoes.
I could get Chilton.
Wait! Rankin and Willingham, when they tossed his cell, they took Polaroids so they could get everything back in place.
Would you ask them to meet me with the pictures of the books? Bowman said, packing his briefcase.
Where?
The Library of Congress.
Crawford checked with the CIA cryptography section one last time. The computer at Langley was trying consistent and progressive number-letter substitutions, and a staggering variety of alphabet grids. No progress. The cryptographer agreed with Bowman that it was probably a book code.
Crawford looked at his watch. Well, we're left with three choices, and we've got to decide right now. We can pull Lecter's message out of the paper and run nothing. We can substitute our messages in plain language, inviting the Tooth Fairy to the mail drop. Or we can let Lecter's ad run as is.
Are you sure we can still get Lecter's message out of the Tattler?
Chester thinks the shop foreman would chisel it for about $500.
I hate to put in a plain language message, Jack. Lecter would probably never hear from him again.
Yeah, but I'm leery of letting Lecter's message run without knowing what it says, Crawford said.
What could Lecter tell him that he doesn't know already? If he found out we have a partial thumbprint and his prints aren't on file anywhere, he could whittle his thumb and pull his teeth and give us a big gummy laugh in court.
The thumbprint wasn't in the case summary Lecter saw. We better let Lecter's message run. At least it'll encourage the Tooth Fairy to contact him again.
What if it encourages him to do something besides write?
We'll feel sick for a long time, Graham said. We have to do it.
15 minutes later, in Chicago, the Tattler's big presses rolled, gathering speed until their thunder raised the dust in the press room. The FBI agent, waiting in the smell of ink and hot newsprint, took one of the first ones. The cover lines included Head Transplant and Astronomers Glimpse God. The agent checked to see that Lecter's personal ad was in place and slipped the paper into an express pouch for Washington. He would see that paper again and remember his thumb smudge on the front page. But it would be years later when he took his children through the special exhibits on a tour of FBI headquarters.
Chapter 15. In the hour before dawn, Crawford woke from a deep sleep. He saw the room dark, felt his wife's ample bottom comfortably settled against the small of his back. He did not know why he had awakened until the telephone rang a second time. He found it with no fumbling.
Jack, this is Lloyd Bowman. I solved the code. You need to know what it says right now.
Okay, Lloyd. Crawford's feet searched for his slippers.
It says, Graham Home, Marathon, Florida. Save yourself. Kill them all.
God damn it. Gotta go.
I know.
Crawford went to his den without stopping for his robe. He called Florida twice, the airport once, then called Graham at his hotel.
Will, Bowman just broke the code.
What did it say? I'll tell you in a second. Now, listen to me. Everything is okay. I've taken care of it, so stay on the phone when I tell you. Tell me now. It's your home address. Lecter gave the bastard your home address. Wait, Will. Sheriff's Department has two cars on the way to Sugarloaf right now. Customs launch from Marathon is taking the Oceanside. The Tooth Fairy couldn't have done anything in this short time. Hold on. You can move faster with me helping you. Now listen to this. The deputies aren't going to scare Molly. The sheriff's cars are just closing the road to the house. Two deputies will move up close enough to watch the house. You can call her when she wakes up. I'll pick you up in half an hour. I won't be here. The next plane in that direction doesn't go until 8. It'll be quicker to bring them up here. My brother's house on the Chesapeake is available to them. I've got a good plan, Will. Wait and hear it. If you don't like it, I'll put you on the plane myself. I need some things from the armory. We'll get it soon as I pick you up. Molly and Willie were among the first off the plane at National Airport in Washington. She spotted Graham in the crowd, did not smile, but turned to Willie and said something as they walked swiftly ahead of the stream of tourists returning from Florida. She looked Graham up and down and came to him with a light kiss. Her brown fingers were cold on his cheek. Graham felt the boy watching. Willie shook hands from a full arm's length away. Graham made a joke about the weight of Molly's suitcase as they walked to the car. "I'll carry it," Willie said. A brown Chevrolet with Maryland plates moved in behind them as they pulled out of the parking lot. Graham crossed the bridge at Arlington and pointed out the Lincoln and Jefferson memorials and the Washington Monument before heading east toward the Chesapeake Bay. 10 miles outside Washington, the brown Chevrolet pulled up beside them in the inside lane. The driver looked across with his hand to his mouth, and a voice from nowhere crackled in the car. "Fox Edward, you're clean as a whistle. Have a nice trip." Graham reached under the dash for the concealed microphone. "Roger, Bobby. Much obliged." The Chevrolet dropped behind them, and its turn signal came on. "Just making sure no press cars or anything were following," Graham said. "I see," Molly said. They stopped in the late afternoon and ate crabs at a roadside restaurant. Willie went to look at the lobster tank. "I hate it, Molly. I'm sorry," Graham said. "Is he after you now?" "We've had no reason to think so. Lecter just suggested it to him, urged him to do it. It's a clammy, sick feeling." "I know it is. You and Willie are safe at Crawford's brother's house. Nobody in the world knows you're there but me and Crawford. I'd just as soon not talk about Crawford. It's a nice place. You'll see." She took a deep breath. And when she let it out, the anger seemed to go with it, leaving her tired and calm. She gave him a crooked smile. "Hell, I just got mad there for a while. Do we have to put up with any Crawfords?" "Nope." He moved the cracker basket to take her hand. "How much does Willie know?" "Plenty. His buddy Tommy's mother had a trash newspaper from the supermarket at their house. Tommy showed it to Willie. It had a lot of stuff about you, apparently pretty distorted. About Hobbs, the place you were after that, Lecter, everything. It upset him. I asked him if he wanted to talk about it. He just asked me if I knew it all along. I said, yes, that you and I talked about it once, that you told me everything before we got married. I asked him if he wanted me to tell him about it, the way it really was. He said he'd ask you to your face." "Damn good. Good for him. What was it, the Tattler?" "I don't know. I think so." "Thanks a lot, Freddy." A swell of anger at Freddy Lowndes lifted him from his seat. He washed his face with cold water in the restroom. Sarah was saying goodnight to Crawford in the office when the telephone rang. She put down her purse and umbrella to answer it. "Special Agent Crawford's office?" "No, Mr. Graham is not in the office, but let me—" "Wait, I'll be glad to—"
Yes, he'll be in tomorrow afternoon, but let me...
The tone of her voice brought Crawford around his desk. She held the receiver as though it had died in her hand.
He asked for Will and said he might call back tomorrow afternoon. I tried to hold him.
Who?
He said, just tell Graham it's the Pilgrim. That's what Dr. Lecter called...
The Tooth Fairy, Crawford said.
Graham went to the grocery store while Molly and Willie unpacked. He found canary melons at the market and a ripe Crenshaw. He parked across the street from the house and sat for a few minutes, still gripping the wheel. He was ashamed that because of him, Molly was rooted out of the house she loved and put among strangers. Crawford had done his best. This was no faceless federal safe house with chair arms bleached by palm sweat. It was a pleasant cottage, freshly whitewashed, with impatiens blooming around the steps. It was the product of careful hands and a sense of order. The rear yard sloped down to the Chesapeake Bay, and there was a swimming raft. Blue-green television light pulsed behind the curtains. Molly and Willie were watching baseball, Graham knew. Willie's father had been a baseball player, and a good one. He and Molly met on the school bus, married in college. They trooped around the Florida State League while he was in the Cardinals' farm system. They took Willie with them and had a terrific time. Spam and spirit. He got a tryout with the Cardinals and hit safely in his first two games. Then he began to have difficulty swallowing. The surgeon tried to get it all, but it metastasized and ate him up. He died 5 months later, when Willie was 6. Willie still watched baseball whenever he could. Molly watched baseball when she was upset. Graham had no key. He knocked.
"I'll get it," Willie's voice.
"Wait,"
Molly's face between the curtains.
"All right."
Willie opened the door. In his fist, held close to his leg, was a fish billy. Graham's eyes stung at the sight. The boy must have brought it in his suitcase. Molly took the bag from him. "Want some coffee? There's gin, but not the kind you like." When she was in the kitchen, Willie asked Graham to come outside. From the back porch, they could see the riding lights of boats anchored in the bay.
"Will, is there any stuff I need to know to see about Mom?"
"You're both safe here, Willie. Remember the car that followed us from the airport, making sure nobody saw where we went? Nobody can find out where you and your mother are."
"This crazy guy wants to kill you, doesn't he?"
"We don't know that. I just didn't feel easy with him knowing where the house is."
"You gonna kill him?"
Graham closed his eyes for a moment. "No, it's just my job to find him. They'll put him in a mental hospital so they can treat him and keep him from hurting anybody."
"Tommy's mother had this little newspaper. Well, it said you killed a guy in Minnesota and you were in a mental hospital. I never knew that. Is it true?"
"Yes."
"I started to ask Mom, but I figured I'd ask you."
"I appreciate your asking me straight out. It wasn't just a mental hospital. They treat everything." The distinction seemed important. "I was in the psychiatric wing. It bothers you finding out I was in there, because I'm married to your mom. I told my dad I'd take care of her. I'll do it, too."
Graham felt he had to tell Willie enough. He didn't want to tell him too much.
The lights went out in the kitchen. He could see Molly's dim outline inside the screen door, and he felt the weight of her judgment. Dealing with Willie, he was handling her heart. Willie clearly did not know what to ask next. Graham did it for him. The hospital part was after the business with Hobbs.
"You shot him?"
"Yes."
"How'd it happen?"
"To begin with, Garrett Hobbs was insane. He was attacking college girls, and he killed them."
"How?"
"With a knife. Anyway, I found a little curly piece of metal in the clothes one of the girls had on. It was the kind of shred a pipe threader makes. Remember when we fixed the shower outside? I was taking a look at a lot of steam fitters, plumbers, and people. It took a long time. Hobbs had left this resignation letter at a construction job I was checking. I saw it, and it was peculiar. He wasn't working anywhere, and I had to find him at home. I was going up the stairs in Hobbs' apartment house. A uniformed officer was with me. Hobbs must have seen us coming. I was halfway up to his landing when he shoved his wife out the door, and she came falling down the stairs, dead. He had killed her? Yeah. So I asked the officer I was with to call for SWAT to get some help. But then I could hear kids in there and some screaming. I wanted to wait, but I couldn't. You went in the apartment? I did. Hobbs had caught this girl from behind, and he had a knife. He was cutting her with it, and I shot him. Did the girl die? No. She got all right? After a while, yes. She's all right now. Willie digested this silently. Faint music came from an anchored sailboat. Graham could leave things out for Willie, but he couldn't help seeing them again himself. He left out Mrs. Hobbs on the landing, clutching at him, stabbed so many times. Seeing she was gone, hearing the screaming from the apartment, prying the slick red fingers off, and cracking his shoulder before the door gave in. Hobbs, holding his own daughter, busy cutting her neck when he could get to it, her struggling with her chin tucked down. The .38 knocking chunks out of him, and he still cutting, and he wouldn't go down. Hobbs sitting on the floor, crying, and the girl rasping, holding her down, and seeing Hobbs had gotten through the windpipe, but not the arteries. The daughter looked at him with wide, glazed eyes, and at her father sitting on the floor, crying. "See? See?" until he fell over dead. That was where Graham lost his faith in 38s. Willie, the business with Hobbs, it bothered me a lot. You know, I kept it on my mind, and I saw it over and over. I got so I couldn't think about much else. I kept thinking there must be some way I could have handled it better. And then I quit feeling anything. I couldn't eat, and I stopped talking to anybody. I got really depressed. So a doctor asked me to go into the hospital, and I did. After a while, I got some distance on it. The girl that got hurt in Hobbs' apartment came to see me. She was okay, and we talked a lot. Finally, I put it aside and went back to work. Killing somebody, even if you have to do it, it feels that bad? Willie, it's one of the ugliest things in the world. Say, I'm going in the kitchen for a minute. You want something? Coke? Willie liked to bring Graham things, but he always made it a casual adjunct to something he was going to do anyway. No special trip or anything. Sure, a Coke. Mom ought to come out and look at the lights. Late in the night, Graham and Molly sat in the back porch swing. Light rain fell, and the boat lights cast grainy halos on the mist. The breeze off the bay raised goosebumps on their arms. "This could take a while, couldn't it?" Molly said. "I hope it won't, but it might." "Will, Evelyn said she could keep the shop for this week and 4 days next week, but I've got to go back to Marathon, at least for a day or two when my buyers come. I could stay with Evelyn and Sam. I should go to market in Atlanta myself. I need to be ready for September." "Does Evelyn know where you are?"
"I just told her Washington."
"Good.
It's hard to have anything, isn't it? Rare to get it and hard to keep it. This is a damn slippery planet."
"Slick as hell."
"We'll be back in Sugarloaf, won't we?"
"Yes, we will."
"Don't get in a hurry and hang it out too far. You won't do that?"
"No."
Are you going back early?
He had talked to Crawford half an hour on the phone. A little before lunch. If you're going to Marathon at all, there's something we need to tend to in the morning. Willie can fish.
He had to ask you about the other.
I know. I don't blame him.
Damn that reporter. What's his name?
Lowndes. Freddie Lowndes.
I think maybe you hate him, and I wish I hadn't brought it up. Let's go to bed, and I'll rub your back.
Resentment raised a minute blister in Graham. He had justified himself to an 11-year-old. The kid said it was okay that he had been in the rubber Ramada. Now she was going to rub his back. Let's go to bed. It's okay with Willie.
When you feel strain, keep your mouth shut if you can.
If you want to think a while, I'll let you alone, she said. He didn't want to think. He definitely did not.
You rub my back, and I'll rub your front, he said.
Go to it, Buster.
Winds aloft carried the thin rain out over the bay, and by 9 a.m. the ground steamed. The far targets on the sheriff's department range seemed to flinch in the wavy air. The rangemaster watched through his binoculars until he was sure the man and woman at the far end of the firing line were observing the safety rules. The Justice Department credentials the man showed when he asked to use the range said investigator. That could be anything. The rangemaster did not approve of anyone other than a qualified instructor teaching pistol craft. Still, he had to admit, the Fed knew what he was doing. They were only using a .22 caliber revolver, but he was teaching the woman combat shooting from the weaver stance, left foot slightly forward, a good two-handed grip on the revolver with isometric tension in the arms. She was firing at the silhouette target 7 yards in front of her. Again and again she brought the weapon up from the outside pocket of her shoulder bag. It went on until the rangemaster was bored with it. A change in the sound brought the rangemaster's glasses up again. They had the earmuffs on now, and she was working with a short, chunky revolver. The rangemaster recognized the pop of the light target loads. He could see the pistol extended in her hands, and it interested him. He strolled along the firing line and stood a few yards behind them. He wanted to examine the pistol, but this was not a good time to interrupt. He got a good look at it as she shucked out the empties and popped in 5 from a speed loader. Odd arm for a Fed. It was a Bulldog 44 Special, short and ugly with its startling big bore. It had been extensively modified by Magnaport. The barrel was vented near the muzzle to help keep the muzzle down on recoil. The hammer was bobbed, and it had a good set of fat grips. He suspected it was throated for the speed loader. One hell of a mean pistol when it was loaded with what the Fed had waiting. He wondered how the woman would stand up to it. The ammunition on the stand beside them was an interesting progression. First, there was a box of lightly loaded wad cutters. Then came regular service hardball. And last was something the rangemaster had read much about, but had rarely seen. A row of Glazer safety slugs. The tips looked like pencil erasers. Behind each tip was a copper jacket containing number 12 shot suspended in liquid Teflon. The light projectile was designed to fly at tremendous velocity, smash into the target, and release the shot. In meat, the results were devastating. The rangemaster even recalled the figures. 90 Glazers had been fired at men so far. All 90 were instant one-shot stops. In 89 of the cases, immediate death resulted. One man survived, surprising the doctors. The Glazer round had a safety advantage, too. No ricochets. And it would not go through a wall and kill someone in the next room. The man was very gentle with her and encouraging, but he seemed sad about something. The woman had worked up to the full service loads now, and the rangemaster was pleased to see she handled the recoil very well, both eyes open and no flinch.
True, it took her maybe 4 seconds to get the first one off, coming up from the bag. But 3 were in the X-ring. Not bad for a beginner. She had some talent. He had been back in the tower for some time when he heard the hellish racket of the glazers going off. She was pumping all 5. It was not standard federal practice. The rangemaster wondered what in God's name they saw in the silhouette that it would take 5 glazers to kill. Graham came to the tower to turn in the earmuffs, leaving his pupil sitting on a bench, head down, her elbows on her knees. The rangemaster thought he should be pleased with her and told him so. She had come a long way in one day. Graham thanked him absently. His expression puzzled the rangemaster. He looked like a man who had witnessed an irrevocable loss. Chapter 16. The caller, Mr. Pilgrim, had said to Sarah that he might call again on the following afternoon. At FBI headquarters, certain arrangements were made to receive the call. Who was Mr. Pilgrim? Not Lecter. Crawford had made sure of that. Was Mr. Pilgrim the Tooth Fairy? Maybe so, Crawford thought. The desks and telephones from Crawford's office had been moved overnight to a larger room across the hall. Graham stood in the open doorway of a soundproof booth. Behind him in the booth was Crawford's telephone. Sarah had cleaned it with Windex. With the voice print spectrograph, tape recorders, and stress evaluator taking up most of her desk and another table beside it, and Beverly Katz sitting in her chair, Sarah needed something to do. The big clock on the wall showed 10 minutes before noon. Dr. Alan Bloom and Crawford stood with Graham. They had adopted a sideline stance, hands in their pockets. A technician seated across from Beverly Katz drummed his fingers on the desk until a frown from Crawford stopped him. Crawford's desk was cluttered with 2 new telephones, an open line to the Bell System's Electronic Switching Center, ESS, and a hotline to the FBI communications room. "How much time do you need for a trace?" Dr. Bloom asked. "With the new switching, it's a lot quicker than most people think," Crawford said. "Maybe a minute if it comes through all electronic switching. More if it's from some place where they have to swarm the frame." Crawford raised his voice to the room. "If he calls at all, it'll be short, so let's play him perfect. Want to go over the drill, Will?" "Sure. When we get to the point where I talk, I want to ask you a couple of things, Doctor." Bloom had arrived after the others. He was scheduled to speak to the behavioral science section at Quantico later in the day. Bloom could smell cordite on Graham's clothes. "Okay," Graham said. "The phone rings. The circuit's completed immediately, and the trace starts at ESS. But the tone generator continues the ringing noise, so he doesn't know we've picked up. That gives us about 20 seconds on him." He pointed to the technician. "Tone generator to off at the end of the 4th ring. Got it?" The technician nodded. "End of the 4th ring. Now, Beverly picks up the phone. Her voice is different from the one he heard yesterday. No recognition in the voice. Beverly sounds bored. He asks for me. Bev says, 'I'll have to page him. May I put you on hold?' Ready with that, Bev?" Graham thought it would be better not to rehearse the lines. They might sound flat by rote. "All right. The line is open to us, dead to him. I think he'll hold longer than he'll talk." "Sure you don't want to give him the hold music?" the technician asked. "Hell no," Crawford said. "We give him about 20 seconds of hold, then Beverly comes back on and tells him, 'Mr. Graham's coming to the phone. I'll connect you now. I pick up.'" Graham turned to Dr. Bloom. "How would you play him, Doctor?" "He'll expect you to be skeptical about it really being him. I'd give him some polite skepticism. I make a strong distinction between the nuisance of fake callers and the significance, the importance, of a call from the real person. The fakes are easy to recognize because they lack the capacity to understand what has happened, that sort of thing. Make him tell something to prove who he is. Dr. Bloom looked at the floor and kneaded the back of his neck. You don't know what he wants. Maybe he wants understanding. Maybe he's fixed on you as the adversary and wants to gloat. We'll see. Try to pick up his mood and give him what he's after, a little at a time. I'd be very leery of appealing to him to come to us for help, unless you sense he's asking for that. If he's paranoid, you'll pick it up fast. In that case, I'd play into his suspicion or grievance. Let him air it. If he gets rolling on that, he may forget how long he's talked. That's all I know to tell you. Bloom put his hand on Graham's shoulder and spoke quietly. Listen, this is not a pep talk or any bullshit. You can take him over the jumps. Never mind advice. Do what seems right to you. Waiting. Half an hour of silence was enough. Call or no call, we've got to decide where to go from here, Crawford said. Want to try the mail drop? I can't see anything better, Graham said. That would give us two baits, a stakeout at your house in the Keys and the drop. The telephone was ringing. Tone generator on. At ESS, the trace began. Four rings. The technician hit the switch and Beverly picked up. Sarah was listening. Special Agent Crawford's office. Sarah shook her head. She knew the caller. One of Crawford's cronies at Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Beverly got him off in a hurry and stopped the trace. Everyone in the FBI building knew to keep the line clear. Crawford went over the details of the mail drop again. They were bored and tense at the same time. Lloyd Bowman came around to show them how the number pairs in Lecter's scriptures fit page 100 of the softcover Joy of Cooking. Sarah passed around coffee and paper cups. The telephone was ringing. The tone generator took over, and at ESS the trace began. Four rings. The technician hit the switch. Beverly picked up. Special Agent Crawford's office. Sarah was nodding her head, big nods. Graham went into his booth and closed the door. He could see Beverly's lips moving. She punched hold and watched the second hand on the wall clock. Graham could see his face in the polished receiver. Two bloated faces in the earpiece and mouthpiece. He could smell cordite from the firing range in his shirt. Don't hang up. Sweet Jesus, don't hang up. 40 seconds had elapsed. The telephone moved slightly on his table when it rang. Let it ring. Once more. 45 seconds. Now. This is Will Graham. Can I help you? Low laughter. A muffled voice. I expect you can. Could I ask who's calling, please? Didn't your secretary tell you? No, but she did call me out of a meeting, sir, and if you tell me you won't talk to Mr. Pilgrim, I'll hang up right now. Yes or no? Mr. Pilgrim, if you have some problem I'm equipped to deal with, I'll be glad to talk with you. I think you have the problem, Mr. Graham. I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. The second hand crawled toward 1 minute. You've been a busy boy, haven't you? The caller said. Too busy to stay on the phone unless you state your business. My business is in the same place yours is, Atlanta and Birmingham. Do you know something about that? Soft laughter. Know something about it? Are you interested in Mr. Pilgrim? Yes or no? I'll hang up if you lie. Graham could see Crawford through the glass. He had a telephone receiver in each hand. Yes, but see, I get a lot of calls, and most of them are from people who say they know things. 1 minute. Crawford put one receiver down and scrawled on a piece of paper. You'd be surprised how many pretenders there are, Graham said. Talk to them a few minutes, and you can tell they don't have the capacity to even understand what's going on. Do you?
Sarah held a sheet of paper to the glass for Graham to see. It said, Chicago phone booth, PD scrambling.
I'll tell you what, you tell me one thing you know about Mr. Pilgrim, and maybe I'll tell you whether you're right or not, the muffled voice said.
Let's get straight who we're talking about, Graham said.
We're talking about Mr. Pilgrim.
How do I know Mr. Pilgrim has done anything I'm interested in? Has he?
Let's say yes.
Are you Mr. Pilgrim?
I don't think I'll tell you that.
Are you his friend?
Sort of.
Well, prove it then. Tell me something that shows me how well you know him.
You first. You show me yours.
A nervous giggle.
First time you're wrong, I hang up.
All right. Mr. Pilgrim is right-handed.
That's a safe guess. Most people are.
Mr. Pilgrim is misunderstood.
No general crap, please.
Mr. Pilgrim is really strong physically.
Yes, you could say that.
Graham looked at the clock. 1.5 minutes. Crawford nodded encouragement.
Don't tell him anything that he could change.
Mr. Pilgrim is white. And about, say, 5'11". You haven't told me anything, you know. I'm not so sure you even know him at all.
Want to stop talking?
No, but you said we'd trade. I was just going along with you.
Do you think Mr. Pilgrim is crazy?
Bloom was shaking his head.
I don't think anybody who is as careful as he is could be crazy. I think he's different. I think a lot of people do believe he's crazy, and the reason for that is he hasn't let people understand much about him.
Describe exactly what you think he did to Mrs. Leeds, and maybe I'll tell you if you're right or not.
I don't want to do that.
Goodbye.
Graham's heart jumped, but he could still hear breathing on the other end. I can't go into that until I know... Graham heard the telephone booth door slam open in Chicago and the receiver fall with a clang. Faint voices and bangs as the receiver swung on its cord. Everyone in the office heard it on the speakerphone.
Freeze! Don't even twitch! Now lock your fingers behind your head and back out of the booth slowly. Slowly! Hands on the glass and spread 'em!
Sweet relief was flooding Graham.
I'm not armed, Stan. You'll find my ID in my breast pocket. Hey, that tickles.
A confused voice loud on the telephone.
Who am I speaking to?
Will Graham, FBI.
This is Sergeant Stanley Riddle, Chicago Police Department.
Irritated now.
Would you tell me what the hell's going on?
You tell me. You have a man in custody?
Damn right. Freddie Lowndes, the reporter. I've known him for 10 years. Here's your notebook, Freddie. Are you preferring charges against him?
Graham's face was pale. Crawford's was red. Dr. Bloom watched the tape reels go around.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm preferring charges. Graham's voice was strangled. Obstruction of justice. Please take him in and hold him for the U.S. attorney. Suddenly Lowndes was on the telephone. He spoke fast and clearly with the cotton wads out of his cheeks.
Will... Listen, tell it to the U.S. attorney. Put Sergeant Riddle on the phone.
I know something.
Put Riddle on the goddamn telephone.
Crawford's voice came on the line. Let me have it, Will. Graham slammed his receiver down with a bang that made everyone in range of the speakerphone flinch. He came out of the booth and left the room without looking at anyone.
Lowndes, you have hubbed hell, my man, Crawford said.
You want to catch him or not? I can help you. Let me talk 1 minute.
Lowndes hurried into Crawford's silence.
Listen, you just showed me how bad you need the Tattler. Before I wasn't sure. Now I am. That adds part of the Tooth Fairy case, or you wouldn't have gone balls out to nail this call. Great! The Tattler's here for you. Anything you want.
How did you find out?
The ad manager came to me, said your Chicago office sent this suit of clothes over to check the ads. Your guy took 5 letters from the incoming ads, said it was pursuant to mail fraud. Mail fraud, nothing. The ad manager made Xerox copies of the letters and envelopes before he let your guy have them. I looked them over. I knew he took 5 letters to smokescreen the one he really wanted. Took a day or two to check them all out. The answer was on the envelope. Chesapeake postmark. The postage meter number was for Chesapeake State Hospital. I was over there, you know, behind your friend with the wild hair up his ass. What else could it be? I had to be sure, though. That's why I called, to see if you'd come down on Mr. Pilgrim with both feet, and you did. You made a large mistake, Freddy. You need the tat.